You're listening to The Quarterdeck with Benjamin Strong and Coast Guard Admiral Jim Watson.
Hi, it's Ben Strong from Amver.com, and welcome to Episode 3 of The Quarterdeck. I'm joined by my co-host, Admiral Jim Watson. How are you, Admiral?
I'm doing just fine, Ben. It's good to hear from you. I understand you've been doing some traveling, so I'm real interested in what you have to report for this podcast.
I think we've both been on the road, and I've just returned from Helsinki, Finland, where I attended the Arctic Shipping Summit up in Finland. You were on the road as well, sir?
I was, and I got a chance to stop into New York City. I was delighted to be a speaker for the New York Marine Society. And I also had a chance to visit your office while you weren't there, as well as the Sandy Hook pilots and a lot of the different locations along the Hudson River and New York City Harbor.
Well, while the L.A. Long Beach folks might argue that they're the busiest port, I think most people agree that New York is a pretty darn busy port. So we're glad to have had you up here, and I'm sorry that I missed you, but I know our paths will cross again soon. But today, I think we wanted to kind of dedicate this podcast to talking about Arctic matters. We've got a great interview with Craig Eason from Lloyd's List, who spent some time on a Sovcom Flot tanker up in the Arctic and actually has a good first-person account of his experience sailing on an ice-class vessel, on an ice-class tanker. And the Coast Guard is no stranger to the Arctic, with our own 17th District having responsibilities in Alaska and the Northwest Passage and lots of Arctic area. And we certainly have a lot of search and rescue from an Amber standpoint, search and rescue interest in the Arctic. But let me just tell you, if I may, a little bit about the Arctic Shipping Summit that I attended. There were probably, I would say, about 350 people representing all of the Arctic nations. Interestingly enough, there was one panelist from China talking about China's interest in the Arctic. And if there was one takeaway that the professor shared with the group, was that we should not be afraid of China's interest in the Arctic. And while a lot of people might say that, what interest does China have in the Arctic? When you consider the amount of goods that are being shipped from China and the shipbuilding going on in China, either A, I would say that that Chinese shipbuilders are going to look at whether or not they need to start building ice-strengthened vessels, and as the IMO expands with the Polar Code, whether, you know, what kind of new architectural, naval and shipbuilding architectural requirements they may be, and whether or not it's economical for them to ship either through the Northern Sea Route or the Northwest Passage. But it was interesting to have some folks not from, you know, the United States, Canada, Norway, or any of our other Arctic partners there discussing shipping. One of the other interesting arguments that was proposed, or one of the other topics that was proposed at the Arctic Shipping Summit, was whether or not people are actually going to use the Northwest Passage or the Northern Sea Route. It was interesting that Rosatomflot, the Russian icebreaker service, has had 15 inquiries for escorts through the through the Northern Sea Route. And while that may not seem like a lot, that it's certainly more than none, and I think it's going to be interesting to see how Russia deals with vessel traffic through the Northern Sea Route. But there were some arguing the fact that sailing in the best phrase that came out of that was, ice free doesn't mean that there's no ice, and the analogy was that there are going to still be, you know, icebergs and bergy bits and things that could be, and a considerable amount of fog. I think that that there were some actual mariners there who said, you know, when you sail in the Arctic, the fog there can be debilitating, and while you may not be iced in, certainly the challenges that go along with navigating through fog and having to slow steam, sometimes, you know, 3, 4, 5 knots, may take a toll on the money saving that is presumed to be sailing through the Northern Sea Route or the Northwest Passage. But there were some interesting debates. There is no shortage of interest in sailing through the Northwest Passage or any of the Arctic sea routes. And Admiral, the Coast Guard has a posture on, you know, on our activities in the Arctic and protecting shipping up there, don't we, sir?
We certainly do. You know, the Coast Guard plays a large role worldwide in safety and security and environmental protection, and managing the variety of activities. Obviously, the Arctic Shipping Summit covered shipping and the movement of goods, and I think it makes perfect sense that you know, nations like China would be interested. It's basically an alternative way around the world. When the Coast Guard looks at this area, we certainly look at those increased activities, but then you overlay interest by the fishing industry, by the oil exploration, oil and gas exploration, cruising, you know, even recreational activities. And our challenge there is that there's really no infrastructure there above the Arctic Circle. It's formerly been so ice covered that there hasn't been a whole lot of activity. No need for the Coast Guard to develop a presence there. And yet, you know, there's well over 1,000 miles of Alaskan coastline that needs a Coast Guard as the area opens up due to the melting ice. So we've got some plans in the works. We're doing a lot of activities that haven't been done on a regular basis in many, many years, and in fact forever, to try to address these situations. But really, we're just crawling as opposed to walking or running because of the challenges that exist there, trying to just create an infrastructure, a base, if you will, to operate from, and then knowing how you have to do things in those difficult environments. But as you mentioned, it's not just the ice. It's there's challenges with lack of navigational aids, with you know, bottom conditions that have not been thoroughly charted, fog. There's actually a choke point there in the Bering Strait, where the distance between Russia and Alaska is actually only about 50 nautical miles, and part of that's very shallow. So it does present some challenges, and I am really glad to hear that there are conferences like what you attended and others that are looking at this and particularly focusing on the safety of life issues.
Well, and that's a good segue into what AMVR does. I mean, not only is the Coast Guard, the United States Coast Guard, interested in Arctic shipping and search and rescue and you know, the protection of the Arctic environment and all things Arctic, really. But AMVR, I've had the opportunity to serve on one of the working groups of the Arctic Council to help strategize on how are we going to perform search and rescue in the Arctic. And one of the, in fact, it was the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment that actually mentioned AMVR by name as one of the, as a search and rescue system, because it uses commercial ships and because a lot of these commercial ships can rely either on each other or they can travel in packs. I mean, there are several different tactics and theories on how shipping can be made safer, you know, almost immediately because of that lack of infrastructure. But I've had the honor of serving with the Emergency Preparedness and Working Group is on the Arctic Council, helping to develop some tactics and strategies. And one of the things that we're specifically working on is how we can link the various regional ship reporting systems of the Arctic together with AMVR so that if there is some type of maritime accident, whether it be a cruise ship or whether it be a ship taking out product and supplies from a mine in Canada, can we marshal enough commercial resources to get to that particular incident and help those people while waiting for either an icebreaker or additional cutters or even aircraft, depending on the environment that the vessel may be in distress. But if I could, I'd like to share with our listeners an interview that I was able to tape with our friend Craig Eason, who's from Lloyd's List, who had an opportunity several years ago to transit on a to sail on a Sovcom Flot polar tanker up in the Arctic, and he has some great insight on what it was like sailing there, the challenges on the bridge, and some of the challenges that the crew faced, and just what a lot of our listeners perhaps don't sail in the Arctic, and I think this gives a good, a nice overview as to what it's like to sail in the Arctic. So, if I may, Admiral, let's take a listen to our interview with Craig Eason.
Hi, it's Ben Strong from Amfer.com, and I'm in Helsinki, Finland at the Arctic Shipping Summit, an Informa Maritime event, and I'm joined by Craig Eason, the technical editor and Nordic correspondent for Lloyd's List. How are you, Craig?
I'm very well, thank you. Thank you.
Appreciate you joining us. And I wanted to sit down and talk with you for a bit because you, not too long ago, had a blog on Lloyd's List called Eason on Ice, and it was about your experience on a Sovcom Flot tanker.
Yeah, it was basically it was an opportunity for me to go and see the developments both of that type of vessel and get a feeling for the crew and how they actually operate these ships. It's an opportunity as an ex-mariner myself to go back onto a ship as well, which I took the best advantage of. So I was on board for just under 2 weeks.
Where did you put in?
Well, I flew into Murmansk and joined the ship in Murmansk, and we went from there to the Varendae platform to load a cargo of crude and take it back to Murmansk, basically. But that meant going through some fairly thick ice during part of that, and that was the bit that I was most interested in. It was just the ability to use this huge piece of technology to go to a platform, go through thick ice, go to the platform, and then stay in position on that platform while the ship loaded the cargo. And the whole thing was just a fascinating opportunity.
How was the, first of all, what was it like with the crew? How were you received by the crew as kind of a outlier? Or?
Well, it was quite funny, really, because I joined and it was a fully Russian compliment.
Okay.
And I was a little bit worried at first, but when I got on board and it was clear that, for starters, all the officers, the deck officers and the engineers, they all spoke English.
Right.
So that concern was gone. Then I found that what they really did appreciate was the fact that I knew a ship. As an ex-navigating officer, you know, it's not a case of talking the talk or being part of a clique, but I certainly knew what the boundaries were. I knew where to go, what not to go, what not to do. You know, I could be sensible about what I was asking and requests that I made during my stay on board. And I had empathy as well for the work they were doing. I could understand what they were doing. I could understand the challenges they faced, and I was able to ask questions and had a genuine interest about, you know, their well-being and their life on board the ship.
You were the proverbial fly on the wall there. Then.
It was. It was a fly on the wall, but also, to use that English expression, a bit like a busman's holiday. I wasn't there doing the job, so to speak, but I certainly knew what they were doing and could sort of take part in a certain element in some of the procedures.
Now, this was a Sovcom Flot ship, and what ice class was this vessel?
It was the highest ice class, and it was one of their vessels that basically has two azipods, ABB azipods, on the stern, which didn't give it dual-acting capabilities, but certainly made it a lot more manoeuvrable through the ice. So there were times when it was, you know, when we went into thick ice, and I was able to see how the captain could use the azipod controls almost like it was something, some sort of space shuttle operation, two hands just holding these dials and able to sort of accurately manoeuvre and spin this massive vessel on a sixpence so that it could just turn it around in a channel and go somewhere else. Because half the time when we were in the ice, the officers were spending all of their watch keeping just staring out, you know, at this white blanket. And anybody who's been to sea will know the importance of keeping a good navigational watch. But that's to do with keeping a watch and looking out for shipping, looking out for navigational challenges.
Oh, I'm sure it takes on a whole different aspect.
It's totally different because you're constantly looking out at this blanket white, an eye-burning blanket white at times if the sun was out. And they'd be looking for the channels, they'll be looking for where the ice is weak, they'll be looking for open water, they'll be looking for signs that will say, yes, we can take the ship that way, because sometimes they may find themselves going 20 degrees to starboard, because that's the way the weakest ice was,
okay,
and going off track, and then think, okay, we need somehow to go back up. And when I looked at the plot of the ship, I'd see the zigzag. But it was this constant looking through the binoculars and looking at the ice, looking at the ice radar. And the level of concentration was phenomenal. And this is one of the things that I underestimated when I actually joined the ship, was the level of concentration that these navigating officers had in terms of actually being able to do this job. And this, we're not talking about doing it for a couple of hours and then that's it for a week. We're talking about constantly doing this, you know, going on watch, coming off watch, going on watch, coming off watch. And it was impressive.
So interesting. What would you say, what were some of the ice thicknesses? I mean, did you go through some pretty challenging thick...
I went out and stood on it.
All right, so that's...
It's quite thick.
That's pretty thick.
I wouldn't say I would be safe to put a truck on it, or it might have been, actually. But I gather some of the ice was near a metre thick.
Wow, okay, so this was serious...
In places,
ice,
yeah.
Ice breaking. And...
We're also talking about some chances where... There were ridges where one of the ice shelf or had gone over or under another one, mm-hmm. and they'd ridged up like that. So from the top of the, from being on the bridge and looking down at the ice, it didn't look that much. But I can assure you, when I was down on the ice and I could see these ridges, and some of them were sort of up to my shoulders in height.
Wow.
Yeah, we're talking fairly thick ice then. So, and this ship, of course, had to have the capability of pushing through it.
No swim falls then on this particular.
No, there wasn't. There wasn't. It was a really interesting voyage. It was fascinating to see the operation of the ship. It was good to see the interaction between the ship and the crew in all aspects. I mean, down in the engine room, there were three engines. And the way that they used the engine power.
Mm-hmm.
They would have one engine, two engines, and then when they needed it, because they're going through a thick ridge, they seem to quite easily be able to turn on the third Batzler engine and power through the ridge, and they'll drop down the load again. So it was a very dynamic use of the ship.
Were there concerns, either from the master or from the crew in the engine room, about use of resources or bunkers? Or
no, but one of the interesting things during that trip wasn't actually... to do with our ship, but we left Murmansk and we went through open water to the edge of the ice.
Mm-hmm.
When we got to the edge of the ice, we wedged ourselves into the ice and sat there and stayed, because at the Varendae platform they have a icebreaker and a support vessel. They had to come to the edge of the ice to meet a bunkering vessel that obviously didn't have the ice class to break through into the ice to go to the Varendae platform.
Okay.
The Captain Gotsky, the tanker I was on, is not allowed to go to the platform on its own without having the support vessel or the icebreaker there with it.
Oh, okay.
So we had to wait until these two vessels had finished bunkering before the three of us then went in.
Together.
And ironically, I think, if I remember rightly, we went in and the icebreaker followed us because we were bigger. We broke the. We made the way for the icebreaker.
Because a nuclear icebreaker?
No. This is. I think it's called the Varendae, and it's a specific built icebreaker for that region.
Now, when you were taking on product at the platform, were you iced in then?
No, the whole idea and the reason for having the icebreaker there is you keep a very exact position on mm-hmm. the ship. You direct yourselves within a certain angle of the boom that points out from the Varendae,
mm-hmm.
and you have to stay there, I think if I remember rightly, within 11 degrees.
Okay.
You can't vary. If the ship changes that angle, then it has to break off.
Okay.
Now, the thing, obviously, that can change that angle is ice drifting down.
Sure.
So continually we have the Varendae icebreaker circling round the ship and the platform, breaking up the ice and just trying to shift it all out of the way.
So there are some unique challenges for that particular ice-breaking crew then as well.
Yeah, I mean, it's
not just cutting a channel or keeping... I mean, there's...
No, they're up kind of upstream of the ice, and they're breaking it down when needed be and making sure that what comes down towards the tanker and the platform doesn't actually interfere with the loading operations.
And then as far as the crew on the bridge... For the loading operation, it's not as if that's a bit of a respite. There's
That's even more intense.
Exactly.
They
I can just
stand
imagine.
Yes. They are stood at the controls for the azipods constantly just tweaking,
sure,
making sure. But I don't think this had full DP capabilities, so the officers would basically break into 2 6-hour watches, so six on, six off. But during that six-hour watch, there'd be two of the officers on each watch, and they would then spend an hour apiece of that 6 hours at the controls.
Wow.
So you'd have 3 one-hour periods during that 6 hours, then you'd have 6 hours off, then you'd go back up on the bridge and do that. The loading operation took a total, I think if I remember rightly, about 18 hours.
Wow.
So it was 3 sets of doing that. By the time they broke off, I imagine they were quite tired.
Yeah, this is no slipshod crew then. These are really highly skilled professional mariners.
And it was incredible just sitting down with them and learning about their own experiences up in the Arctic. The captain that was there was a fantastic guy, one hell of a character. He was telling me about all of his career in the Arctic, and he'd been working up in the Arctic for about 20 years.
Wow.
He'd started on some of the Murmansk timber company or something like that, or timber ships, and you know, he'd developed this respect and understanding of the ice, and he could point at the ice and just tell me exactly what was going on. We were getting radar pictures of the region, ice radar pictures, and he was able to say, well, I think this, that and the other, if we do this route we're going to have a problem with drifting ice here, and he had all this backup information in his head, and he was able to say, right, we're not going to go that way, it's best to go that way. And in doing so, he actually sort of, you know, saved time or saved a potential problem of getting stuck in an ice block that was drifting in the wrong direction.
Wow, that's amazing. I mean, really, this guy knew his
stuff. Oh, he knew his stuff.
He really knew his stuff.
They all did.
Yeah.
They all did. I mean, the chief officers there were trained captains anyway. And what was good, though, is they also had a third mate who was, you know, just... Yeah, still a little bit wet behind the ears.
Right.
But nonetheless, you could see that this, you know, this is the beginning of his career as an ice navigator.
Mm-hmm.
And he was able to then, you know, he got an opportunity, this sort of learning progression, to learn from these people around him.
Real indispensable training there. Isn't it?
Unbelievable. Yeah.
Well, based on some of the discussions that we've had here, talk about the Northern Sea Route, and there's discussion of the Northwest Passage. I mean, do you see Arctic shipping, ice shipping increasing, or do you think that perhaps...
It will increase. We've heard this throughout this conference over the last 2 days. There's increased demand for two types of shipping. The transit shipping that will take cargoes over the Northern Sea Route. There seems to be a thought that this will develop more slowly than the other shipping, which is the one that's actually in the region.
Mm-hmm.
So the ones that are pulling out dedicated cargoes of minerals or oil and gas from the Arctic region. The vessels that are going up there offering some sort of support for the drilling capabilities up there and the other infrastructure projects that we have. That is the area that seems to be developing a lot stronger, a lot faster. And that's where you're going to need these kind of crews, this skills, and I wonder sometimes whether we've got enough people to do all that with capability. We're going to start spreading that skill base too thin.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we might start finding we're going to have some problems. There needs to be some way of ensuring that ice competence remains at a high level.
Sure.
And that people actually have the opportunity then, to, like this young third mate on the Captain Gotsby, to actually learn from other people and to develop a sort of progression, a succession of knowledge, that we've got all the people needed.
So perhaps there's a business model for the Russians or the Finns or some people for ice training.
Well, yes, there is already, and they have a very dedicated area for ice training. It's a very important area for Finland and for Russia. The Sovcomflot have got their own ice training.
Mm-hmm.
There's ice academies already in existence, and so it's a very much that it's being developed. It's being developed, but whether it's being developed quick enough for this developing growth and shipping that's going to go up there, I don't know. The other problem that you're going to have is ships that visit this area for a short period. They won't have necessarily ice dedicated crews.
Right.
They may have people going up to Newfoundland or into the Arctic that have got no experience. It's just that somebody's contracted a cargo to pick up a cargo from in the Arctic region. So they could turn up without the right equipment.
Sure.
That's a liability in itself.
Yeah.
This ship may only do one lifting in the Arctic region a year, or may do it once every 5 years, and as a result there's no experience. So you need to be able to make sure that you've got like an ice pilot that will come on board.
Mm-hmm.
But even so, that ice pilot has to have confidence that the people on the ship know what they're doing.
Right.
You know, it's no point teaching them to sort of understand what ice is all about from scratch. There needs to be a certain level of understanding.
Sure, they've got to be competent with the vessel that they're on, not just newly aboard. Or...
And there's things to bear in mind there. With people who go to sea and become navigating officers on oil tankers, for example, they get the dangerous cargo endorsement. Now, I know there's talk within the Nautical Institute and elsewhere about having something similar for ice, so that you can have an ice endorsement. It doesn't subtract or anything. It's just one of those things that says, yes, I'm an experienced navigator, and I've got a basic understanding of what being in the ice is all about.
Of your understanding of the proposed polar code with the IMO, will those type of endorsements be there?
I don't know, and I'm in a way, even though I say what I say, I'm also concerned about a polar code that's going to be too prohibitive.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you start legislating too heavily, you end up then having no shipping going up there at all.
Right.
People are going to be too scared to go up there.
Sure.
You make the risks, the political legislative risks, too high, even though, you know, we're looking already at the physical risks and the training risks. We've got to be careful. We've got to strike a balance there.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate you taking some time and talking with us. If folks want to learn more about what you have to say about Nordic issues or technical issues, they can go to LloydsList.com and probably just put Craig Eason or your last name, E-A-S-O-N, in the search box, and all of your products will come up for
you. And it all pops up, exactly.
Excellent. Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
You're welcome.
All right, and we're back. That was an interesting interview with Craig, and it really shed some light on the challenges of what the Russians or what anybody is facing as they sail in the Arctic. You know, Admiral, you mentioned some things such as the our 17th District and their Arctic domain awareness flights, which I understand have already started now for the 2011 kind of Arctic season. But I also noted that in their Coast Guard Authorization Act, which was just passed, the Coast Guard is taking steps to implement different recommendations from the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment. Is that right, sir?
Yes, we are. First of all, we're very focused on the Arctic Marine Shipping Assessment, and we're working with the Arctic Council and the IMO as far as working beyond our own walls here within the Coast Guard on the issues. So much of what we do will depend on what international shipping does, what the commercial activities are that will drive the need for a Coast Guard mission set up there. The Arctic awareness flights are being conducted with our C-130 Hercules aircraft. They actually launch from Kodiak, and it's a long ways to get up there. It's 1,000 miles just to get from their base up to the Arctic seas and the Chukchi Sea up there, where they begin these awareness flights of the activities north of Prudhoe Bay. Those flights are being conducted every 2 weeks between March and November. They survey the sea ice, they monitor the vessel traffic, they try to report back on what might be the challenges if different contingencies come up regarding the activities that they see there.
Mm-hmm.
And they test their equipment. We've had some challenges with our airborne navigation equipment, our communications equipment, just being able to do the kinds of things that we take for granted below the Arctic Circle. So those flights have been very valuable, and we will continue to do them and look forward to getting more information from the international bodies working on projections of activities there.
Well, it's interesting that you mentioned the some of the challenges faced even by the air crews up there, because that was a common thread among the participants at the Arctic Shipping Summit in Helsinki, is that all the equipment, whether it be a small boat, whether it be trucks that may be used to truck infrastructure and, you know, boom, or even environmental response equipment, everything seems to work differently in the Arctic. And, you know, we've never faced these challenges before because there was always ice there, or just the challenges of working with the indigenous populations there who, you know, perhaps the ice for them is really land versus frozen water for us that may be viewing things from a shipping standpoint. You know, it's just, it's fascinating, and I don't think we're alone. At least that's not my understanding, talking with the participants in Helsinki. We're not alone in these challenges. All of the Arctic nations are facing it, and arguably the rest of the world that's engaged in shipping and looking for either a less expensive, a faster, yet safe way to move goods back and forth from Asia to Europe and the United States. So it's an interesting dynamic, and it's certainly one that's not going to go away.
Yeah, I mean, this international cooperation, everybody sort of facing the challenges together as they evolve, has been, I think, a fascinating area for the Coast Guard to be participating in. We're working very closely with the Canadian government. We have both a North Atlantic Coast Guard Forum and a North Pacific Coast Guard Forum that involves, you know, countries like Norway and Denmark and Russia and Sweden and, you know, all of the countries in the Arctic Council. And we discuss these things at our forum meetings and have actually had joint exercises. The one that my command here has been directly involved with has been with the Canadians on some of their high-latitude activities that's been done jointly between the U.S. Coast Guard, the U.S. Navy, the Canadian Navy, and the Canadian Coast Guard. So those things are very, very helpful. Back to some of the things that the 17th District is doing, you know, with our populations in Alaska. As you say, this is something that appears to be new and a little concerning to them. So there's a tremendous amount of outreach to the residents of the northern parts of Alaska. We've had pollution exercises. We've had emergency towing exercises, a mass casualty response, because we have had some cruise ships up in that area. We've definitely increased our boating safety outreach activities, and I think they appreciate that. They sometimes feel so remote from the mainstream United States agencies that when we go up there and we talk about wearing life jackets and all that, that actually it touches them. There's commercial fishing vessel safety exams that are being modified for the commercial fishing fleet that goes up that way. And then, of course, there's an awful lot of activity involving the ports that are really more like small boat harbors, but they're being looked at for increased activities and, you know, the potential that we could have to do some more of our port type of functions of working with pilots, working with terminal operators and that sort of thing than we have in the past.
Well, you know, it's certainly to the people up in Alaska, and I know that all of our Arctic partners are working with the residents that live in that, you know, above the Arctic Circle. It's no surprise that we truly are engaged in trying to get our hands wrapped around the Arctic issue and how we're going to respond to things and train people to work in that environment, you know, better and safer and just ensure that there's less risk to life and property and to the environment. And I think it, in some regards, and keeping in mind that we're a life-saving podcast, which is part of the Amber system, I would be remiss if I didn't say to our listeners, if you're in shipping and you, regardless of where you sail, but especially if you're sailing in the Arctic and you're going to be, you know, perhaps you're an offshore supply vessel and you're working around some platforms or things in the Arctic, perhaps you're you work with Sovcomflot and you're sailing the Northern Sea Route, we'd like you to enroll your vessel in Amber, and we'll have a link in the show notes on how to do that. But right now, really, one of the best resources for search and rescue is going to be other commercial ships. You know, one of the fears that people mentioned at this Arctic Shipping Summit was the cruise industry up there, and it, you know, it poses a threat, and I don't think it's anything that any of our, collectively, any of our various maritime organizations, whether it be the U.S. Coast Guard or any of our Arctic partners, is taking lightly, and we're exploring all means to provide search and rescue services up there. But, you know, an actionable, something that a shipping company can do today is enroll in Amber, make themselves available, and answer the call for help should something happen up in the Arctic. Because, you know, we're probably all familiar with the cruise ship Explorer that sank in Antarctica, and Amber has a strong relationship with the International Association of Antarctic Tour Operators. I hope that we can build that same kind of relationship in the Arctic with both the tour and cruise industry and the commercial shipping industry. So I would certainly say, if you're sailing anywhere in the, you know, North Polar regions, enrolling your ships in Amber helps us exponentially.
Absolutely, I think we're more dependent on Amber and those high latitude waters, as well as, like you mentioned, down in the Antarctic, than we are any other places in the world. And we highly encourage this this buddy system for ships transiting up there, particularly ones carrying passengers. But really, any type of vessel that is entering into ice-infested waters should be traveling at least in pairs, if not in a larger group, with a icebreaker that's outfitted for the purpose. One of the things that the Coast Guard is also engaged with is the improvements that need to be made in our own inventory of icebreaking Coast Guard cutters. We really have three polar icebreaking cutters, but over the last several decades, they've been almost totally devoted to research and scientific support. And they're spread pretty thin because they do work in both the Antarctic and the Arctic. Two of the vessels are over 30 years old, and one is in the yards and is going through some multi-year yard upgrades. So we're very thin in that capability to actually provide heavy ice breaking. But there's a strong focus on that right now, and we're working toward a future with a lot more capacity than we currently have.
Well, there's certainly no shortage of challenges, and it's good to know that that we are working to address those challenges, and we're working with our partner countries, encouraging the commercial sector to assist where possible. I'm going to make sure that we've included some links to the 17th District with their Arctic Domain Awareness Fact Sheets, and just to their news page, so that if people are interested in learning what the Coast Guard is doing specifically up in Alaska, they can have that. Admiral, are there any other resources that people can turn to if they want to learn more about what the Coast Guard is doing from an Arctic standpoint?
Well, I think you can always go to the Commandant's Compass site and pick up information when it's breaking on developments. There's also, you know, I think a fair amount of reporting that is going on in the in the industry news outlets. We will be, I think, constantly talking about the Arctic in the various venues. I'm sure there was some discussion of it at CMA, and of course, you have these focused meetings all around the world. So I would be on the lookout for Coast Guard presentations throughout the year on Arctic developments.
Yeah, we've actually got an emergency preparedness working group meeting of the Arctic Council coming up in June, where I will be presenting on this AMVR partnership with the various Arctic nations and their regional ship reporting systems, which besides just helping to build kind of a blanket of safety around the Arctic from a business standpoint, if we get all the countries agreeing to share this information in a similar arrangement that we have with other regional ship reporting systems, those who are familiar with AMVR know that we have information sharing agreements with Japan, with their JASREP system, with Australia and AUSREP, and with the Chilean search and rescue vessel tracking system, CHILREP. But from a business standpoint, it's less bridge work. It's one message that you have to send that's then forwarded to various vessel reporting schemes that may be required by a particular flag state or by where a vessel is sailing. So from a business standpoint, it saves you time, it saves money in satellite transmission costs, and it increases safety, so it's a no-brainer. And then in later this year, a similar Arctic Shipping Summit that I attended in Helsinki will take place in Canada. It'll be the North American Arctic Shipping Summit. In fact, if they have a link available, I'll include that in the show notes as well for people who may be interested in either seeing what papers are going to be presented or in attending. But I think that anything that we can do as an industry to build awareness and on safety, on the indigenous people, on the environment, anything to just make Arctic shipping safer, then we're certainly doing ourselves a favor.
Absolutely. Yeah, if I could just go through, I think some of the key things of our Arctic strategic plan. Mm-hmm. It includes goals of protecting the Arctic environment and conserving its biological resources, ensuring that we have a natural resource management and economic development plan that's environmentally sustainable in the Arctic region, strengthening institutions for cooperation among the eight Arctic nations that make up the Arctic Council, and we are going to spend a lot of time working those relationships, but also involving our Arctic indigenous communities, as we've already talked about. That's a key part of our plan. And then finally, enhancing the scientific monitoring and research in those regions so that we can know where the environment is going to inform where we need to be going in terms of our capabilities and overcoming our limitations.
Certainly a comprehensive approach, so that if people are concerned about the Coast Guard or AMVR or anybody's interest in the Arctic, we've recognized where the challenges lie and where we may have shortfalls and working to address those. And it may take some time, so we're going to rely on our partners, indigenous peoples, and the commercial sector to help us there, regardless of it. Not just focusing on search and rescue, but whatever type of incident may evolve in the Arctic. I should add, and like we say with every podcast, this isn't just Admiral Watson and I talking about whatever the topic may be, whether it be the Arctic shipping or whatever. We'd like to hear from our listeners. So if you have questions about the Arctic, anything about the Coast Guard, about AMVR, commercial shipping, if there's something that you want to ask somebody that's a decision maker or in a command position in the Coast Guard, this is probably the best forum for you to do that. So I know, Admiral Watson, you'd agree with me. People can leave comments on the blog from this particular podcast, and we're happy to share what we know with them, correct?
Absolutely. I'm gaining a real appreciation for this form of information sharing to the maritime public, and I do look forward to any questions or comments that they have.
Well, sir, I think we've had a good discussion of things in the Arctic. We've heard what it's like to sail there. we're trying to strong arm our listeners to see if we can elicit some questions, and perhaps there are some folks out there that may also have something to add in the comments because they sail there regularly. But hopefully we'll hear from our listeners, and I look forward to meeting you again next month, sir, so we can share another topic on the quarterdeck.
I'll see you next time, Ben. Good talking to you.
Thank you, Admiral.
You have been listening to The Quarterdeck. Learn more about the Amber program at amber.com. The Quarterdeck theme song is called Botany Bay by the Blackguards. Available at musicalley.com or follow the link in our show notes.
Anchor lays to command the gang of navvies. They told me to engage. Well, I thought I'd stop and bore a pint before I went away. But I take a trip on an emigrant ship to the shores of